Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The hemorrhaging of newspaper jobs has slowed a bit, but as the dust settles on the latest purges, the news is worse for minority representation inside the newsrooms. Demographically, the country is becoming more diverse, but the opposite is true in newsrooms these days. The Columbus Dispatch, perhaps, is a prime example. A year ago, 45 people were laid off at the Dispatch, including two black women, 33% of its minority staff. Joining us today to talk about the shrinking ranks of minority journalists, what that means for consumers, and where they see themselves fitting in the future are two Kiplinger Fellows from the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State University. Heather Faison is a multimedia journalist, formerly of the Philadelphia Tribune, where she worked as a copy editor, entertainment writer, and graphic designer. Heather served as the editor-in-chief for the District Chronicle's newspaper in Washington, D.C., and as a religion and health reporter for the Baltimore Examiner. She's a 2007 recipient of the NNPA, I got to find out what that is, Ford Foundation Black Press Fellowship. She earned her bachelor's degree in journalism from the John H. Johnson School of Communications at Howard University. I know I said I wasn't going to rattle all that off, Heather, but I did anyways because it's impressive. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Also with us, Chandra Thomas. She's an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in People, Essence, Ebony, Newsweek, Upscale, Heart and Soul, The American Prospect, and Atlanta magazines, as well as Root and Time.com websites. She was named Journalist of the Year for 2007 by Region 3 of the National Association of Black Journalists, and also Print Journalist of the Year by the Atlanta Press Club. She was an associate producer for the Fox affiliate in Atlanta, so she's worked on different platforms, and as a producer for the ABC affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama. She was also a reporter for the Birmingham Post-Herald newspaper. Chandra, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here on this rainy Wednesday.
It's good for the complexion, I always say.
Well, my complexion should be great here in Ohio. Flawless.
Were you surprised to hear what the rate of rain is in the city?
Oh, my gosh. I'm like, if it's not snowing, it's raining.
Yeah, forevermore, you'll always check the weather statistics wherever you go.
Absolutely.
No. How have you been here for a year at the Kiplinger program? How's it been?
Well, actually, we've been here for 6 months.
Six months, that's right.
Since January. We came at the height of the snow, which is probably why I'm bringing it up. But it's been interesting. It's been a great experience, and we've learned a lot.
You know, I kicked off with those. I didn't actually mention specifically statistics, but the recent American Society of Newspaper Editors annual survey was bad enough, as I said, but you know, you have to wonder about the newspapers that didn't even respond to the survey. There's more out there that were lost, and I couldn't find the Dispatch in there, for example. But what do you make of the numbers?
Well, they're not surprising. It's a trend that's been going on for quite some time, and as a younger journalist, it is, you know, a bit discouraging. You see the nation changing, becoming more diverse. But yet you have the media that's not changing. And there is a old Washington Post reporter that once said, you know, if you don't look like the community you cover, then that's a problem. And it is an increasing problem. And the Washington Post is one of the places that I interned as a student. And they, you know, have been credited for their diversity. But, you know, even they have work to do. So.
What are the struggles do you think that newspapers have faced in getting more diversity in the newsrooms? Because if you talk to, you know, the recruiting people at many newspapers, they say, we try, we can't. What do you think, Chandra?
I'm not convinced that's the challenge. I think it's just no longer a priority. You know, I'm fortunate, and I won't say my age, but I did intern and do a lot of my internships and my early work in the 90s. And at that time, that was the buzzword, diversity. I know Gannett, which is one of the companies that I worked for in Nashville, which owns the USA Today, were, you know, that was their thing. I mean, they had all kinds of programs, and, you know, they even had mandates in USA Today. I don't know if they still exist, where you had to have a person of color or a woman above the fold in every paper on the front page every day. And so that might seem a little bit forced, but the reality is, you know, my experience is that it's just no longer a priority. And it's even worse when you step out of newspapers. You know, working in a newspaper, I think people still view the newspaper as sort of like a public service to the community. But then when you get into your specialty magazines and even your TV stations, you have a lot of you don't have as much of that focus. And with television, you tend to have a lot of pressure for the on-camera person. You know, you want to have your diversity, but the people really making the decisions in the background, that you don't see, because obviously the audience sees, oh, we want a black anchor or we want an Asian anchor or whatever to show that diversity. But the person making the real decisions, who are, you know, not following directions but actually making those calls, you don't see it.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. And my guests are Heather Faison and Chandra Thomas from the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. They're two Kiplinger Program Fellows. They've been here since January. And poor them, the weather hasn't been too great. But it was a good April. You know, I'm telling you, it was a really good April. Marty Kaiser of the ASNE, he's the president of ASNE, he called those numbers that we were talking about disappointing. He said that without diversity in our newsrooms, we miss reporting on important stories in our communities. What do you think we're missing?
You're missing a more diverse point of view. It's not so much meeting a quota, having African Americans or women or whatever. It is the diverse opinions that you bring into the newsroom. And, you know, you could really look at it how the newsroom is, well, the industry is really at a decline financially, and you can look at diversity because of that, because you no longer have just different elements coming in, different people bringing in new ideas for the web, new ideas for the print editions. You just pretty much have the same people from the same tribe, so to speak, mm-hmm. Speaking the same languages.
And it's not just a matter of color, is it? It's exactly. A lot of things. It's what religion you are. It's what street you grew up on.
Age as well.
Age.
I know one of my challenges when I was trying to be an intern was that I always wanted to be in the features department because I love trend stories, but the features was sort of like the thing you had to move up to. So everybody was, I don't know, 35 plus who worked in the features department. And so I'd be like, why don't you want like a younger perspective? And I think that's probably part of the reason why newspapers are dying, because they are the younger people, that's who the audience is. But the people making the decisions are like the parents of the younger people. So I think that, you know, like you said, diversity isn't even just race. It's age, it's sexual orientation, it's a lot of things, religion. And so I think what Heather said, you know, is right, that it's really about the perspective. I worked at Atlanta Magazine, which anyone who knows much about Atlanta, it's sort of like the hip hop capital right now. It's like the hot place for reality TV. And I worked for Atlanta Magazine, and I was the only person of color on staff. And Atlanta is historically, you know, the civil rights movement, black mayor, and everyone would be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're the only, you know, person of color.
I'm surprised.
That writes for the magazine. And so I used to raise certain, you know, points and things like that. And in fact, I got the job through a diversity fellowship, you know, initially with the magazine. So I do think that focus was there. But I think what happens is people kind of get caught up in when there would be, you know, positions available, you'd say, well, hey, why don't we look at, you know, this different person or different people? And they would say, well, this person is qualified, or whoever they ended up getting. And not to say that they weren't qualified. But, you know, as Heather said, it's not just about, oh, this person can do these skills. It's about the perspective you bring. And what I find is you have kind of like the same profile of people kind of running magazines or making those decisions. So you pretty much get the same perspective.
And, yeah, walking into a newsroom, I would sort of cringe when they would bring in an African-American candidate. You knew they were walking them around because the newsroom was so white. And, you know, naturally, it's just natural. You want to look around and see someone, for lack of a better phrase, like you. Now, it isn't always as simple if you're gay or lesbian, but and there's other, ways to look at it that you can't see. Mm-hmm. But how much does that play a role when you were out there being recruited? And I dare say you probably were recruited by different newspapers. What was it like, Heather?
Well, I will say that that is an issue, and I think it becomes an issue of retention, because even in, you know, different places that I've worked, when they did go ahead and hire someone of color, particularly an African-American male, like there was always more black females right. than I would ever see African-American males. And a lot of times people didn't stay long because they didn't feel like they had the support. They didn't have that colleague or person that could mentor them. And so even if you get in the job, you're not going to necessarily keep someone if they don't feel like they have the support that they need. And you know, for me, I've always created that outside of my newsroom. So I always had my network behind me. But as far as in the newsroom, that is a huge deal. You want to feel like you have someone, even if it's not your boss per se, but you want to have some ally, someone you can go, you know, sit and have coffee and complain with.
Right.
But if the people around you
the
are
great American
problem,
journalist pastime.
Yeah. So that's always been very important. And that's why Heather and I both are members of the National Association of Black Journalists. That organization has been really helpful in just creating that backup for us, you know, to create the opportunities and also to have that, you know, that venting session where you can discuss some of the challenges that you face. And you feel much better knowing that other people are dealing with the same issues.
It's such a natural thing, but I don't know why they think that the furniture and the computers are going to be the, you know, the big turn on. So,
yeah, I was just going to say my experience is slightly different because I started in ethnic media. The newspaper that I started with is a black-owned newspaper
in
Washington. Philadelphia.
Oh, in Philadelphia. Okay.
So the experience was different, and even with that, I was very hesitant as going into the black press. I had my friends going to the Gannett papers and Time Inc. publications, and I'm like, I don't know if I want to do this. But I had a conversation with Milton Coleman from the Washington Post, and he started in the black press, and he's like, you need to do this. It's going to be a good opportunity for you. You're going to get a chance to do way more than your friends who are at Gannett and Time Inc. Trust me. And I took him at his word, and it was a great experience. You know, there are downfalls to any publication,
sure.
but it was a great place to start. I got to do a little bit of everything and just really take advantage of being in a large market for news, which Philadelphia is.
Now, the black press newspaper is suffering as well, struggling
mm-hmm.
mightily. That's a huge loss as well.
Yeah, I think and just to piggyback off mm-hmm. what Heather said, I think that's another challenge. Like you said, the black press is dying, but then there's also that fear, you know, which is probably what Heather was alluding to, of the stigma of, oh, you work for the black paper.
Right.
So you don't get, you know, so it's kind of like your resume, and you may feel like, oh, well, I might be only viewed as only being able to do black stories or black issues and that type of thing. So that's a challenge. I think the problem with the black papers struggling is the issue is usually, you know, ad revenue. They're not getting the dollars, and so they're cutting back. And then, of course, that affects the quality. And so it's really tough.
Same thing that's happening to the rest of the industry, really, but to a greater degree in some cases. We've got to take a short break. Then we'll return with Chandra Thomas and Heather Faison of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. They're both Kiplinger Program Fellows getting ready to take off, so we grabbed them before they did. If you have any questions or comments for us, we're talking about minority journalism and the good, the bad, and the ugly in the United States right now. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock, and it's Wednesday, so the political junkie is stopping by to discuss the results from the big primaries in Arkansas, Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Kentucky. The political junkie on Talk of the Nation at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus with light rain. Cloudy skies this afternoon, a high of 65. Clear skies tonight and a low of 48 degrees. Sunshine tomorrow and a high of 78. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Heather Faison and Chandra Thomas of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. We're just talking about how I pronounced their names right off the bat and forgot to
ask.
It's one of the foibles of the job. It can be if you don't double check on name pronunciation. So, yay, I did it. What are the foibles of journalism these days? What are the pratfalls that you've experienced, and do you think that maybe the journalism's falling short? Newspaper journalism will focus on that.
Well, my biggest gripe, I come from a graphic design, web design background, so I bring that element combined with the print. So even throughout school, my biggest hang-up was, why aren't newspapers moving faster and more in a more innovative way to the web? And it was very frustrating trying to combine, you know, as starting out in graphic design and switching to journalism and finding out that there was not much of a bridge. There was this very large gap with how newspapers were dealing with even social media. You have blogging and Twitter, how publishers are so hesitant to jump into these online platforms where your audience is. This is where your readers are going. I think that's the biggest thing for me.
You know, with the blogging thing, sometimes the blogs are just news bites. They're not really blogs.
That's
not
what
I think of as blogs. They're just another place to put stuff that you can't
get
in the paper.
I mean, that's what journalists are doing. You know, they're saying, oh, I heard about
this,
and then that's it. Yeah.
So or they're just Twittering things that are in the papers. They're constantly putting links in the paper, and I don't need that. I already get that on Facebook, and I get that on emails and that kind of thing.
Right.
I don't need someone Twittering another link to the paper.
Some publications do it differently. The Chicago Tribune, they have their regular Tribune feed, and they have this extra one that's really witty, very funny. So there are publications who are taking it a step further, but not many are.
Well, obviously, everything costs money, and it's difficult to switch the people from what you think of as the traditional news gatherers to the online format. It's tough. It's
not
difficult.
Not if you hire young journalists. Putting a pitch in there for
Heather. Two more will be on the market in a few weeks.
Yeah, and that's another, you know, that was also a challenge. Not so much for me because I'm actually, you know, not Miss Technology. I'm not, you know, but I did realize pretty soon that multimedia was the way to go. And I did a fellowship at Berkeley in California. Like, there's a lot of workshops and programs. So you go to Berkeley and they show you all this neat stuff, and then you get back, and then your newsroom is like, oh, that's great. But we don't really have any money to do that. And it wasn't necessarily expensive stuff, but I mean, it was just, so that's the challenge you face, is you come in with these great ideas, which is part of what we do at the Kiplinger program. And then you have to go back to your newsroom, and you've been in this environment where everything is encouraged and try this and try that. And then you get back to your newsroom, and they're looking at you like, well, we don't really do that way, or here's our template and we do that. And, you know, that's definitely one of your challenges.
For an industry that reports on news and trends and change and all that stuff, the news business has changed. The newspaper business has changed. I don't know about television, but in radio, I've only been doing it for about 9 months. But the newspaper business changed very little over the years. The hierarchy of
Hence
it.
Hence the problem. That's what we're talking about. They're not changing
well,
fast
enough.
Well,
I just wanted enough. To make you to say it.
They're not changing fast enough. And actually, the cuts have been really problematic because I still consider myself in many ways a traditional journalist. And the problem is, you know, for a year and a half, I freelanced, and you go to a newspaper and you have this great story idea and you're really excited. And coming from that environment where you had graphics and you had a picture and you had your copy and this wonderful layout, and now they're, you know, the company that I was working with, they're like, oh, well, we don't have a graphics department anymore. And, oh, can you get them to send us a stock photo? And so, and then by the time, you know, I've spent all this time, and, you know, we journalists, we love our words, and we've, you know, painstakingly gone on every word.
Yeah.
And then it gets run in some little column on the side with a stock photo, and you're like, okay, this doesn't look anything like the time I put into it. So that's the other problem, is with all the layoffs, they don't have the staff. And so I think the quality of the publication is diminished greatly.
Right. Is this the future of journalism? Is this the journalism of the future? Maybe is that a way to put it, because it seems more like, in many ways, the journalism of the past.
Yeah. So it's horrible.
We have some calls and an email.
Uh-oh.
first one is from Ed. Ed wants to know how minority journalism has changed for the better or for the worse. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you. Minority journalism, to me, brings out two different ideas. One is minorities in journalism, and the other one is journalism about minorities. And it seems like for years our journalism about minorities has focused so much on either the best of the best, the newsmakers, let's say, like the Jesse Jacksons or the Clarence Thomases or whomever, or the worst of the worst, the latest crime, what's going on in, you know, why are we having so many of these people in jail? But it seems like there's a vast middle ground where nobody gets covered for the most part. And I wondered if they have noticed or seen any changes, whether that's actually changed, and what their view on journalism about minorities actually might be. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Ed.
Heather?
That's a good point. I think one of the biggest news stories that I saw as it related to African Americans recently was why such a large percentage of African American women were not married. And this was it was on Nightline. It was everywhere.
It was 20 years ago too, I think.
It was, yes. We are recycling the same stories, the same ideas, the same concepts, and there is a lack of balance. I'm trying to think of the website.
Which one?
Yeah. Anyway, one of the news sites, they have a section called Race and Ethnicity, and it's really good. And then you have The Root, which is owned by Washington Post. So there are publications, or there are outlets, mostly online, though, that are presenting a little more balanced presentation of African-Americans or minority news. But, you know, it's rare.
Well, I think one thing is that there are two issues that, like, with the caller raised, there is coverage of achievement from people of color, like, you know, like you said, the outstanding examples, or, you know, the high profile person. I think the challenge that we also face is that we want to be incorporated into, hey, let's do a story on, you know, soccer moms, and you just don't automatically assume it's like the blonde woman who lives in whatever suburb you can think of. So I think there's two issues there, is we want to have the high, you know, coverage of what we consider achievement, but then we also want to say, hey, when you do a fashion story, make sure you have a Latin person in there, an Asian person. And I think that's, you know, two sides of the issue of coverage. And I do think there have been strides in both areas, but I do find, again, when you have the same people with the same perspective covering stuff, a lot of stuff kind of is like missed. I mean, I've witnessed situations where it was like a story, particularly, you know, in the city that I live in. You know, I work with a lot of different media outlets, and you always go, why didn't they have a person of color in that story? And I mean, not necessarily a black person, but an
anything
Asian person,
but
a
white.
Latin
yeah.
person.
Yeah.
So, I think that, you know, I think that's why you need, if Heather and I were in the room, I'd have been like, hey, I know someone who's perfect for this. But if we're not there, then we can't say that.
Two, and also, and this happens in politics, too, I noticed, people tend to go to the same people over and over again as resources in the community. I think at Poynter Institute, when I went there, they called them touchstones. And, you know, you can call them what you want, but they always seem to be the same people over and over again. So even though they might be of color or of a different religion or something like that, it's still just really ultimately one perspective.
I call them the usual suspects. But and it's worse than TV, because literally you would have a meeting at 9 or 10 a.m. and you have a noon live shot, and it's whoever answers their phone in the next 30 minutes who gets to be on a noon show. So, you know, and so what I would try to do a lot is, you know, work with, the, you know, say the black colleges and things like that, and try to bring in some of the experts, because it's really more laziness on the part of the journalist, where I just kind of can call this person. But then it's on the part of, you know, that alternative source to make sure that they respond to the needs of the journalist, and saying, okay, you need someone on the camera in 30 minutes. So it's kind of a, you know, double-edged sword there.
All right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. We're talking about minority journalism. We are going to talk with Heather and Chandra about their projects at the Kiplinger program at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at OSU in a few minutes. First, let's take another call from Jonathan. Jonathan, you're on the
air.
Hi,
how you doing?
Hi.
First, I'd like to say that I agree with every single thing you've said, and I think that it's a big positive that the pro-diversity movement has stretched as far as it has. But I'm a historian, and I'm a pretty old guy. I can remember listening to the radio and reading newspapers in 1960 when the only sources were middle-aged and older white men. And the three of you couldn't have those jobs that you have right now or about to have. There were glass ceilings everywhere. So I see how quickly, it seems to me, the diversity movement has pushed forward. It may seem like it takes a long time. It may seem like that you're running into obstacles here and running into obstacles there. But in the scale of history, 40 or 50 years to go from having a society where there were glass ceilings everywhere and everyone was a white middle-aged male to having much more diversity, I consider that a huge positive. And I think we should be, in some sense, applauding that, not so much knocking the slowness of current lack of diversity measures, but applauding the fact that we as a society have been able to move forward so quickly.
Well, it is much better than it was, say, in the 70s, but I guess I thought, Jonathan, we were kind of talking about the backslide.
Well, you're talking about the backslide, and now I'm old enough to remember far, far worse than any little blip down now. You know,
Good Lord.
You wouldn't have that job. Ann Fisher would be your only jobs on the radio that would be available to you would be female oriented type jobs. Okay.
Well, yeah, and, I see. Yeah, it's true.
And now you can't have that job.
I think it's a good point, but it shouldn't have taken 30, 40 years, you know, for this kind of progress.
That's only because you're younger. If you look further back, let's look back over the 200 and something years of the United States, or look back over the 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian societies and look at that 40 years in comparison, and you can see how quickly everything has changed.
Well, my concern, to some degree, and even with the layoffs, this is even challenged. My issue is not so much that there are people of color who are worker bees in a news environment. The question is, who is making decisions? And I think if you look at the numbers, and this is not, and you would not believe the numbers for 2010, and they're worse now because of the economy and the issues with newspapers, there aren't a lot of people making decisions. And so it's great to say I have a job somewhere, but if you're not really making decisions or in control, then, you know, that's something that you still have to look at.
That's
a huge
that,
issue.
I can agree with you, but in 20 years, you're going to be old enough and are going to have moved up the system far enough that you will be making the decision. And things will then be
not
better
necessarily.
Again.
There may not be a newspaper.
Well, I think, you know, I guess, you know, the question and the reason why I brought up the topic today, Jonathan, was the trajectory of journalism right now does not favor minorities. It never has. Or people, you know, in less powerful, you know, women or minorities or whatever it is, you know, like any big industry. I guess that's exactly what we're talking about. Is where the trajectory is now. For many years, from the 70s on into the 90s, it was huge. I mean,
was
there was huge strides.
And now it's going down.
Right.
So all the progress that you described is actually going down now.
Yeah, we're going backwards. Well,
but I get your point.
But it's going down from a considerably higher level than where it was. And I see the going down that you're talking about as a short-term blip that is going to turn around again just because of the nature of the demographics of the United States. And within another 20 or 30 years, there will be no recognition even of, you know, this is a black person, this is a woman. There won't even be any consciousness of that because all of these minorities, everybody who is qualified will have risen far enough to be making the decision. These things don't happen overnight.
Right. Well, you know, actually, I wanted to get into that, Jonathan, about what would trigger that. And I think, thanks, Jonathan, for your call. What might trigger that, of course, is what's always triggered lots of everything along the years, which is technology. There was a story from the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education last October, and they said that the very white online news association needs to unite with minority journalists if they want to reach a mass audience, that the emerging audience isn't just about relationships with technology, but also demographics. And the findings of the 2010 census suggest that the United States will change from majority white to majority brown in our lifetimes, and a very young majority brown, and which is much more comfortable online on Twitter. There's a disproportionate number of African Americans on Twitter, for example. Not, you know, obviously it's still a majority white, but what do you think about that? Because I know, Heather, that's you know, what you're working at, multi-platform. What do you think?
Well, technology can certainly be a catalyst to bridge the gap. But then you also have an issue of access. We, Chandra and I, as well as the other CAPS, are very fortunate to be in this type of fellowship where we are learning more about social media and technology and how it relates to our jobs. But a lot of journalists don't get that type of opportunity. And like Chandra was saying, you go back to your news organization to, you know, sort of this environment of, you know, pessimism. And you're like, well, what do I do with all these skills now? But yes, technology is certainly an avenue that should be used more, that should be promoted more in news organizations across the board. And, you know, and it's something that can, it transcends race and class and ethnicity, as long as there's access to it.
Right. There is the access gap. And that's geographical, really, more than anything at this point. But we're going to take a short break, and we'll get back to calls. And the emailer wants to know about what you do at Kiplinger Programs, so we'll get into that because it's very interesting, their projects. When we return, if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Capital City Radio is the new HD radio service from WOSU. Get an eclectic blend of blues, rock, world, folk, and alternative country on Capital City Radio, which means an opportunity for great musical discoveries 24/7. Keep up with the local music and concert scene with shows like Groundswell Columbus and Capital Noise. Listen to Capital City Radio on WOSU HD3 89.7 FM or online at capitalcityradio.org.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, we'll hear how a 19th century female novelist became a global phenomenon 200 years after her death, and how Jane Austen's ambition and creative genius contributed to her present-day fame. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Westfield Insurance, exclusive sponsor of In the Know, where St. Charles meets Delaware Hayes in this season's final match on Friday at 8 p.m. on WOSU+. Westfield Insurance, sharing knowledge, building trust.
55 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today with a slight chance of rain throughout the day, and a high of 65. Clearing skies overnight, a low of 48 degrees, and sunshine for tomorrow, and a high of 78. A few clouds on Friday, and a high of 77. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Heather Faison and Chandra Thomas of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs, where they are Kiplinger Program Fellows. I wanted to talk about what you're doing because your projects, both of them, are very interesting. And I think, Heather, why don't we start with you? Your project is about obesity among African-American children. Tell us what, you know, inspired it and where you're going with it.
Well, what inspired my project was really my family. My parents are taking care of one of my younger cousins who is 7 years old, and he is obese. So just looking at them really struggle and try to figure out the best solutions for him. And in looking at my family, I realized that it wasn't just all about income, because when you hear obesity or childhood obesity as it relates to African Americans, you think poverty, you think lack of access to food. And that is the case in some scenarios. But looking at my family, where we don't have those types of restraints, I realized that there are also some cultural issues at hand. So I took that and proposed it here at the Kiplinger program, and in the end, you know, it ended up being a look at childhood obesity and its impact on African Americans, African American families, and also food access in Philadelphia. That is a big topic in Philadelphia. So also, of course, looking at food access and how families with limited access to grocery stores are forced to go to corner stores. And of course, it's, I mean, the food at the corner stores is less than healthy,
and they pay more for it.
And they pay way more for it. So I, over the course of the 6 months, pretty much, that I've been here, I've been in communication with one family and their son who was obese, and just kind of with them in their journey and really talking to them. And it's been really awesome. So it's the element with the family, and then also looking at the food deserts, because there are some amazing initiatives taking place in Philadelphia as it relates to childhood obesity.
How did you do that long distance?
A lot of travel. I pretty much, with everyone that I talked to, and I'm sure all the other KIPs had the same approach. We did the pre-interview over the phone because you don't want to get all the way back down there and you're like, okay, this person's not going to work.
Yeah.
So the first couple months was a lot of pre-interviewing. And then when I went down there, my first visit to Philadelphia, I had dinner with the family to see if they would be on board. And they are just, they were amazing. They really were amazing. So the last couple of visits, I just spent a lot of time with them. Their son's name is Jason. He's 14. I went to his practices. I was there after school. I was there at dinner. You know, I just pretty much embedded myself in their family. And it was a rare opportunity because they really opened up their doors and opened up their heart. And obesity is not an easy topic to discuss, but what I realized that, and you realize that as a journalist, that people are more willing to talk and to tell their stories than you think. So,
now, what are the different elements in it? You obviously you're going to be writing, but right. What else did you do?
There is a print story, but the rest of it is video, and it will be running on Philly.com this summer. So there are roughly 3 to 4 videos, and the cornerstone is the video of the Foots family. And it is a pretty powerful video. It's coming together really well, particularly from the mother's point of view, because one thing I love about First Lady Michelle Obama, who has taken on this issue as a personal campaign.
And I might add, Heather's kind of downplaying it, but she came up with this idea long before that initiative was announced. So now it looks like she's just kind of joining the group. But she did come up with that before the First Lady announced her initiative.
Thank you, Chandra. But that's a good point about, you know, covering minorities and ethnicity, because I came up with this project. Nobody was talking about childhood obesity, especially not African Americans. But now you have, thankfully, First Lady Obama jumping on the issue, and everywhere she goes, she mentions how it affects African American and Hispanic children. So now it's something that's way more prominent. But thank you for that. Yeah, so
that was very sweet.
Gotta give her kudos.
The cornerstone is the video of the family, and it's really from the mother's point of view and Jason. And you just really see how this is not just a child's issue. This is a family's issue. It starts in the family. It starts in the home. And this is a two-parent home, you know, and there are elements in this story that you really don't get a chance to see as it relates to childhood obesity. So you really see how it not only changed the son, but it changed their entire family.
How's he doing?
He's doing really well. This is actually, I'll kind of wait till everything is done. But yes, he's doing very well. And you just really see the journey that this family had to take, because they had to look at themselves and say, wow, what are we eating? Are we exercising? Are we being the example for our children? And they had to answer some difficult questions. And in this discussion of childhood obesity, that's really what's going to have to take place. We're going to have to stop looking at kids and start looking at parents and guardians.
Yeah, that's a great point.
In schools and all
of
it.
Oh, yeah, in schools. And the print story, and that's why you need both elements, because the print story goes more into detail about the schools, and there are a lot of changes that will be taking place in the next year, you know, credit to First Lady Obama again. And then you also have the environments that people live in. There are roughly 4 areas that researchers target, and it includes the schools, the home environment, which is culture, what are we eating, how are we preparing these foods, and then the neighborhoods. You know, I lived in Philly for a number of years. I lived in pretty much all parts of the city. and the parts where you have the highest concentration of minorities, you're just bombarded with McDonald's ads and Kentucky Fried Chicken. Like, you see this everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. And it does impact the food that you put in your kitchen table. So.
Now, Chandra, yours is about the aftermath of Katrina.
Yes, I'm actually a native.
Again, all involving children.
Well, actually, I've sort of expanded beyond that. You know, that's the beauty of being a journalist is you have to always be open to your story evolving. And that's sometimes a challenge because sometimes you have this tunnel vision, like, I'm going in and I'm going to find, you know, this or that. Mm-hmm. But it's a very personal story to me. I'm a native of New Orleans, and I moved away from New Orleans when I was 13. But my entire family, with the exception of my mother, lived in New Orleans. So, I mean, I was always back there. And my grandparents lived in this community, this historic African-American community called Pontchartrain Park. And it was funny, when I came here, my intention was to, I was like, I want to talk about Katrina and I want to talk about children. And, you know, that was kind of the initial idea. And when I, you know, joined the fellowship, everyone said, you know, the closer something is to home to you, the more passion you're going to have for it. And of course, being a native of New Orleans, I knew I wanted to shine a light on Katrina. So in doing my research, I started, you know, finding more information and more information. And I decided that the best thing for me to do would be to highlight the community that my grandparents lived in. It's a very important community. It was created out of the separate but equal mandate, where basically the city leaders of New Orleans created this black community that had the amenities of if any other white community. We have a golf course. We had two universities. We have a ball field and a clubhouse and tennis courts. So it was a really nice suburban community. And so, again, going back to what Heather said, I felt like I wanted to change the profile of the Katrina victim. We sort of see the images of someone in the Superdome and they're poor and they didn't have a car to get out of town. And that was kind of like the image that we've received. And then we have the Lower Ninth Ward and, you know, that kind of thing. And I felt like this was a community with 96% home ownership for 50 years. And they only had 10, I think like 8 foreclosures in the height of the foreclosure issues from 2000 to 2010. I think there was like 8 foreclosures. So you look at the fact that my family, you know, who are from here and lived here until Katrina, basically lost everything. My grandparents had 8 feet of water in their house, and everyone in this community lost everything. This community was under, they say, somewhere between 8 to 10 feet of water for 2 weeks. So, I mean, literally nothing left. So what I'm really highlighting, and this was also a community that was 60% elderly. So you look at the fact that you worked your whole life, you did everything right, your kids went to college, you paid your taxes, and now you have nothing. And the government and your insurance company is basically not doing what everyone thinks that they should do to help you. One woman I interviewed, she said she paid her homeowners for 50 years. She and her husband, 50 years, and they didn't get a penny of insurance money to rebuild their home. And so these are the kind of issues. So I'm really weaving the story through the personal perspective, but also talking about these big issues that people are still facing. The Katrina anniversary is August, 5 years. And I, as recently as March, saw homes that had never been touched. I mean, not even gutted. I mean, literally right. Clothes in the closet and pictures on the wall, that type of thing. So I'm really trying to show that it's been 5 years and they're showing you the French Quarter and Mardi Gras and thinking, oh, everything's great in New Orleans. But it really isn't for the homeowners.
Right. I mean, the French Quarter was back in, you know, in business.
I don't know, like just 6 months later.
I was going to say weeks, but it's probably months.
Which
faster
is understandable.
Than you would think. And they need to do that because tourism
is tourism,
such a big deal. But when I went down there and did some volunteer work, it was shocking. We did a show on Detroit a few weeks ago, and what a devastation that is of social circumstances, not a flood. But it reminded me of the communities of Katrina and all the houses. And you would go, and it would be every 50th house would have somebody in it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I know that in some neighborhoods, it's still that way. So you wanted to turn the stereotype on its head a little bit and tell the story of another.
Yeah, I think, depending on where you stand, you may think that, if someone's poor, they didn't contribute to society and that type of thing. And I mean, that's not for me to say, but I feel like this is a great example because these are people who did everything that, I mean, I think universally anyone would agree is important. They worked all their lives. Like I said, they paid their homeowners insurance, paid their taxes. They owned property and passed it on in their family. And also, just were contributing members of society. The kids went to college. I mean, this is a community that produced a lot. The first African American mayor of New Orleans, and the third, his son eventually became mayor. And we have a Grammy award-winning trumpet player, Terrence Blanchard, Wendell Pierce, who's an actor on HBO, which HBO just premiered the show Tremé, which is about New Orleans. Mm-hmm. This is the first district attorney of New Orleans produced this community. I mean, this is the community that produced all these people.
And now it's gone.
And it's, and the community was about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. It was supposed to be like this big event taking place, and Katrina happened August 29th, and this was supposed to take place like in October or something like that. So this is a community that's very strong, and they're fighting to come back. And they've actually created their own vehicle. They created a community development corporation, which is, interestingly enough, teaming up with a company here in Columbus, which was another reason why I chose to do this project. The same company that SRP Development, which built the student union at OSU, and also the Jesse Owens Stadium.
Yeah.
They are actually rebuilding my grandparents' community.
That's an interesting link. Now, why that company? Why that?
Basically, it's somewhat random. Basically, Congresswoman Maxine Waters in D.C., she's of California, she basically sent out a call to action for African-American-owned companies to get involved in the rebuilding of Katrina. And she apparently had a relationship with all these different companies, and she sent them all to D.C. and said, hey, we need to come up with some plans to rebuild New Orleans. And this company basically, I'm cutting down a lot of details,
sure,
but basically put in a bid and joined forces with some companies in New Orleans, and they got the bid, and they're rebuilding the community. They just unveiled some model homes last Friday. So they're actually coming up with ways for people to get back into a new home if their home is too damaged to be rebuilt.
So what happened to your family? Are they back?
Unfortunately, my grandmother, she lived with us in Atlanta for 2 years. Three years. And unfortunately, she passed away right before she was able to go back to her home. So that's like the personal reason why I chose to do this is, as I mentioned, it was 60%, seniors. My grandmother was 80 years old when she passed away. And you don't have 5 and 10 years for your community to come back when Katrina hit and you're already 77. So that's part of the issue in this community is that these are older people. They don't have the years that, say I would or some of my other relatives might have. So some of my family's back. Some chose to stay in Atlanta. Some have moved to other parts of Louisiana because of their jobs, and then some are back. So it's kind of a mixture, but it really is a – it's been a really devastating process to really start from scratch.
What's your prediction for New Orleans 5 years out now?
I definitely think you'll see progress, but I think the demographics of New Orleans will be changing greatly. I think there's a lot of effort to make sure that certain people don't come back, and that. But on the positive side, I think there's going to be a lot more diversity as far as race there. Because there's been a lot more Latin people, mm-hmm. The Latin population has come in and seen opportunity to get into the construction and start businesses and things like that. So I think it's mixed.
How when you choose these kinds of stories to do, how much do you feel like this is what you have to do because you're African American and you need to be talking about these issues, and kind of like a watchdog for the news business and making sure things are maybe feel like you're rushing around trying to get a lot of stuff done because there's not enough people to do them.
It's a little mixed for me, but really I'm a journalist. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. That's just kind of how I view things. You know, even though I, you know, got my start in Black Press and it was great, but you know, that wasn't my plan. You know, I just wanted to tell stories and to bring in all of the elements of the graphic design and web, but stories need to be told and someone needs to tell them. But what's interesting about the census data you just mentioned about how really in about 20 years or less, the population of this country is going to change. And if we have minority, you know, African-American, brown people and young children, and if most of these children are having all these health complications, it's no longer a racial issue. This is a people issue. This is an American issue. And I think that's the biggest push for me as a journalist too, as African Americans, to get people to see this isn't just like an issue for me and my family. This is an issue for everybody.
Chandra, what inspired you to get into journalism?
Actually, I decided to become a journalist in 11th grade. I love to write, and I'm really nosy, and I figured, hey, if I could get paid to ask people questions and meet people, then they always say, do what you would do for free and make money at it. And so that's what I do.
Well,
not a lot of money. Anybody want to hire me? No.
That's not why you go into journalism, is it?
It is not at all why you go into journalism.
But I think back to what Heather said, as you see, we both chose something that was sort of personal. So I think it's just about passion. And when you're passionate about something, it's going to show in your work. And you know, I'm like Heather, you can send me out anywhere and I'm going to get the story. But I think for something so in depth and we're going to spend 6 months of our lives on it, I think that as you see, it started off as this passion, this passionate issue for us. But when you look at the numbers, you know, my numbers support that there's a problem in New Orleans. Her numbers support that there's a problem with obesity in African-American community. Right. So that was just a starting point.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for joining the show today. I really appreciate it and hope we hear from you more in the future, because both of those are stories we follow here as well. Heather Faison and Chandra Thomas of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. They're both Kiplinger Program Fellows and they'll be leaving us soon. And I'm glad we had a chance to squeeze them on the program. Thanks again.
Thank you. We had a great time.
All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.